September 16th. Health First Committee meeting is ordered. In attendance is myself, Alderman Soling, Alderman Fulcher, Alderman Cordials, Alderman Transier, city staff. Do you have any public comments?
Yeah, I had nobody in the room.
Okay. Item number one, minutes for correction. Anybody have anything?
None.
We will take the minutes as presented. Moving on to new business. Item number one, PW 2025-81, ordinance amending the Yorkville City Code nuisance.
Well, this is what I get for asking Kathy how to change how much I can charge for mowing vacant lots. I gave it to her for that, and I got this back. But in all fairness, it is a good update and was needed. It kind of cleaned everything up and gave us a more definite timeline that is much shorter than the 45 to 60 days that the other one was giving, like between mowings. Now we'll be able to go out after 5 days, after our week of, you know, non-compliance, we could go mow it, and then they go through the adjudication process. Whereas the former one was send them the letter, and then after 30 days, if they don't respond, you send them another letter, and after 15 days, then we can start the process. So we were already 45 days in, which is three mowings if it's a habitual offender. So it's basically a cleanup of that. It kind of cleaned up the language of who could write the tickets. It just kind of spells it out more specifically. And other than that, I don't think there is a lot of other substantive changes. If anybody has any questions, I'm glad to answer them.
Nothing, anybody have any comments? I think this will go to full council, since we're going to be amending. Say so. Yeah. Let's move that to city council.
Okay.
Okay. Moving on, item number two, PW 2025-82, water audit update presentation.
All right, so this is an update to the committee, and Michelle from my office is going to run through it. She does all of our water audits, not only for the city, but multiple other communities, and certainly well-versed in going through the process here. So just a reminder, this is something that we have to do on an annual basis now, moving forward, is we're connecting to Lake Michigan. And something that will have to continue as long as we're using Lake Michigan water. So with that, Michelle is going to walk us through it.
Is there a better place for me to stand so people will hear? Okay.
Nope, that's fine. There's nobody online either, so.
Is there?
Yeah, a next slide? Yes, there is a next slide.
No, but I think this might be the next item on the agenda.
Oh, yeah, I pressed the wrong button.
Sorry.
Too many presentations.
Yeah, we're flooded with them tonight, for sure.
I'll try to be as brief as possible.
You don't want to comment on quiet zones and train horns?
I think Chris, he likes that stuff. We're going to go with it. We get geeky on different things, right? But the point of tonight is just to provide you an update of where we're at with the water audit. It's obviously a requirement in order to connect to Lake Michigan. So just wanted to run through, give a little bit of the background of the water audit and our progress, talk about what we're doing to try to get to under 10%, and then just talk about the Lake Michigan allocation status. So with that, just general goal is we're comparing the amount of water that's coming out of your treatment plants to what's actually being billed out. Everything else is non-revenue water. So if you're not billing for it, even though you know you're using it in a good way, it's non-revenue water, and that's how IDNR looks at it. So this audit is based on the AWWA M36 manual. It's industry standard. So IDNR typically provides this form to you and says fill it out, along with an LMO2 form that we had to fill out. you keep going. So this is just historical audits. I will say, like, 2012 to, I want to say, around 2020 or 2020, I think it was 2020, it was more just looking at build data and pump data, and we had to make some assumptions based on records and that sort of thing. We started being a little bit more mindful and were able to retrieve a slightly better data in those 2021 and on. But you can see our, for water year 2024, we're at about 100 million gallons of non-revenue water, and we're at 14.2%. One other thing that I'll just mention on this too is when we're grabbing the billing data, this is probably getting into the weeds a little bit, but when we're grabbing the billing data, there's different read dates right now because we don't have all the meters on the same system yet. So we're making different assumptions between 2023 and 2024. Like we used to say, I think it was the 14th of the, or the first of the month. And then this time we looked at the range of the dates and we averaged them. So it's being calculated a little differently, which is probably why our non-revenue water pops up in that 23-24 era. So this, when we submitted for the Lake Michigan allocation permit, we had to put together a non-revenue water reduction schedule. IDNR is not necessarily holding you to this schedule. They just want you to get under 10% before they let you connect. So that's ultimately the goal we're trying to get to. So you see we're not quite hitting that non-revenue water reduction schedule. But this schedule, it was a requirement they put on us, and I don't. It's hard to kind of dictate how things will fall. So we still need to get under 10% and recognize that. So if you move to the next slide. Now that we know how much non-revenue water generally we have, the audit form generally breaks things into three categories of non-revenue water, and you do that so then you understand how you start attacking these categories. The first is the unbilled authorized use, second is apparent losses, and third is the real losses. Unbilled authorized use, it's you flush your hydrants. Construction uses, in Yorkville's case, they don't have treatment loss because we're generally getting stuff out of the effluent meters, but fire use, you're not paying for that water. Apparent losses are kind of your paper or economic losses. That's where you have billing inconsistencies. Transposing data within the billing system and read system with the meters. Customer meter inaccuracies, they're like the intangible stuff, you know, and as well as theft. Real losses are physical, you can see them. Your ground storage or your storage tank overflows, or you have water main breaks, leaks, water services, but they're more like you can see those losses. So those are the buckets we're trying to get to and then figure out how to attack them. With that, this is not uncommon. This is for 2024. Real losses appear to be the largest component based on how the water audit form calculates it. So those are your like water main breaks and leaks. And that is why IDNR was very, very adamant about increasing the water main replacement, and which we did. But there's a lot to be said about those apparent losses and unbilled losses, and we'll get into a little bit of that as we go through the presentation. So what we did is it's called a water system improvement plan is what IDNR likes to talk about, and we really went after each one of those three categories. So if you move on to the first one. First, we had like some general plan items that didn't necessarily pertain to any given one of those three categories, but it was, we agreed to complete annual water audit, establish a water loss team internally. City staff has been meeting pretty regularly. It's a constant discussion, and there's been education within the city staff to make people aware of what we're trying to do. And then we agreed to monitor those impacts of the non-revenue water initiatives. So moving on, this is the first category, and what seemed to pertain to Yorkville, and that is unbilled authorized water use. So Eric, John, and other staff, and Rob, they've done as much as they can to convert unbilled water use to billed water use. And even beyond that, they're trying to meter stuff that they didn't use to meter. So we at least know the quantity of some of the stuff as opposed to guessing. And that goes to that second bullet point of improve the tracking of that unbilled, unmetered water. Just with flushing hydrants, construction use, really kind of just, John, I know, carries a spreadsheet and, yep, and provides that, which is wonderful. So you're at least having consistency in reporting that data, which is great. So from an apparent loss perspective, some things that the city has implemented is master and effluent meter testing, and they are doing that annually. If you don't know what's going into the audit, the data going in, if you're not confident in that, that becomes problematic. You really don't know how much you're managing. And this is your biggest, in one of your biggest inputs into that audit. In addition, on the flip side, on the billing side, the customer meter replacement program has been huge. And I believe Eric and his team has started to kind of test some of those meters to see the improvements on them, and it seems like maybe there's possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. We tested a couple already, and we're going to keep testing them every couple of weeks. And we found that, well, one was very accurate. The other was at 92% in high flow, 92% in regular, and 0% accurate in low flow. So anything between a quarter and a half gallon per hour, it was not getting. So you're very slow drips, but over time that adds up to be a tremendous amount of money. We just got those in, I think, yesterday or the day before we got those in. And the next round, we want to do some of the larger meters. I want to see if some of those, how inaccurate those older, larger meters are, since they were such heavier users. And I will report that back.
So really trying to hit those hard. Then we're going to we recommended to review the billing software and replace and update if necessary. You know, it's my understanding an older system and consistency in getting the data and how the data is put in sometimes gets it very hard to query it. So that was just something to kind of review. And then review policies and enforcement efforts of illegal water use was, you know, make sure that you have a way to enforce misuse of the water. From a real loss perspective, we've implemented the GIS tracking of water main breaks that helps to create a better understanding of where the water main replacement needs to be. That's another step in that right direction. And then city is doing an annual leak detection on 100% of the distribution system. The water main replacement is probably, in terms of dollar amounts, your biggest ticket item. And this is what we're trying to avoid overdoing, right? So, but I think the agreement with IDNR is we were supposed to replace 7.2 miles through 2027, and we're well on our way for that at about 5.4 miles, so great job. And then we're also supposed to develop an ongoing water main replacement program, so you just don't stop. It's a continual battle with the non-revenue water.
Can I say one thing? On that last slide, Bart, sorry, all the circles on there are water main breaks. So those are geographic locations of some of our water main breaks through the years.
Yeah, thank you. Good add. So the water main replacement program has been updated through 2030 at this point. I think all in total, it's from 2023 through 2030, I think you're a little over 9 miles of water main that you'll replace. So another 1.8 miles plus have been added to in those next coming years. That said, does the volume of real losses really make sense? So how the real losses are calculated in this audit spreadsheet is it requires you to put some pretty small estimates at your billing errors and your meter replace or your meter errors and all that, and then everything else becomes real losses. So by default, unless you're proving them wrong, you need to have really good data for your billing data, your customer meters. You want to make sure the water you're pumping in is good. You want to make sure that's right. Otherwise, your real losses look too large. And you can see we're replacing a decent amount of main, and we're not quite getting where we need to be. So there's something more is what that's telling me. And we need to focus on getting stronger data. So, and I'll go ahead. You can kind of skip through. This is, I was just talking about how it's calculated in the, and I generally went over that, so you can go to the next slide. So where do we want to focus on moving forward? As I said, I think our focus has to be better data. That's really the goal. If you go back to the AWWA manual that this is all based off in, it's getting better data and not necessarily reducing your water loss. So the two highlighted ones there, I think are critical. Your two biggest inputs are your metered water into the system and then your billing data. You got to feel strong on that. I think Eric and John and your team has done a great job with the meter. They're really on top of it. They get the meter accuracy testing. They really track that hard. There's just a lot of data when it comes to the billing side. And having a third party come in, data scientists come in and take a look at that data and find anomalies, that's like all they do in their world. It seems kind of like a crazy job to me, but there's people that do that, is kind of recommended just to feel that confidence in that data. And the other big thing is your customer meter replacement program. Right now, we're just assuming a couple percentage, I think, in the audit that it's going to. Well, is it really more than that? And can we get better data there? So those are kind of the two areas. We got to keep doing the other stuff. It's a multifaceted approach. You got to hit all these categories, and we're going to continue to hit those categories. But those couple things, I think, are really going to lead us to better data. So with that, we recommend expediting the following to be completed as much as possible. I know the meter replacement program will get to all reads we were talking. We'll at least get all read data by next month.
Supposed to be, yes. Hopefully. Yeah. And then I want to bring the second part of the meter replacement forward so we can start working on that so we can just continue on. And once that is complete, we will be on all radio read and all up-to-date newer radio read. So that way we really will have an instant snapshot. It will take us less than a day to get all the reads. And we could actually then focus on the billing software, which is the last piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, and just thinking this through, you want to, your last chance at this, your water year audit goes from October 1 to September 3rd, or October 1 to September 30th in every given year. So you want to connect in January of 2028. So your last year you really got to hit is October 1 of 2026 into September 30th of 2027. So you really are trying to do whatever you can to get under by that October 1, 2026. So you have a full year of data of feeling good and looking good. Everything's not going to be done. I mean, you guys are working on probably one the tightest time frame out of all the people trying to connect to Lake Michigan. But you're doing a solid job, but I think getting that data is good. So trying to speed that up. Lake Michigan status, yeah. Final order, we got it on October 14th. We did meet with IDNR this summer with staff. And had a good discussion with them, told them about what we're doing with our water system improvement plan. They don't, just so you know, IDNR, it felt like at that meeting, they just want to see you get to under 10%. We asked them if there's anything more we could be doing, and they liked our approach. They didn't have a problem with our approach. The IDNR permit, I don't know, has actually been issued.
It is not. They keep saying it's just being held up because of paperwork on their end or lack of staffing on IDNR's end, but at some point, we're going to need it, right? So we'll keep pressing them on that.
And that submit last water audit to prior to Lake Michigan should actually be January 2028 and go October 1 of 26 to September 30th of 27. And then we'd go for DWC commissioning in spring of 2028 and connect to Lake Michigan in summer of 28 is right now where we're, what we're aiming for, working towards. So with that, any questions? Seems like an exciting topic to everyone.
I don't know if the question is for you, but I know they want you to get to 9.9 loss, right? Mm-hmm. Would it make sense to try and get under that to give a little wiggle room if something were to happen? Because what happens if in your annual audit you go from 9.9 to 12 or 11.5?
And I think we are definitely trying to get better than 9.9. That's the goal. There's a point of diminishing returns because you spend too much. Like, I don't want to get to less than 9.9 if it means going out and replacing miles and miles of water main because the payback's not there. However, if we can get under, I think doing some of these other things, you'll get
comfortable.
Yeah, we'll get there.
And what is the repercussion if one audit comes back after we connect to Lake Michigan water and it's at 11.5 and not under 10?
Once you're connected, there isn't a penalty necessarily.
So they want you connected before, and then they essentially say, okay, you've done what we need you to do.
Theoretically, every few years, they're supposed to reallocate. So, you know, they could eventually say they just haven't done it to anybody yet.
And they just raise your rates if you're not
raise
under
our rates
10.
Or hold us to the replacement plan, make a very
severe... They'll ask you to come up with a plan. Right. There's all sorts of existing communities on Lake Michigan
that are over 10.
Way above 10%.
Sure.
Yeah.
Because they haven't done any work since they got on there
in
35
the 80s.
Years ago.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Any other questions? Item number 3, PW 2025-83, quiet zone update presentation.
All right, so if the water audit didn't put you to sleep, the quiet zone may, but Chris has been, he's our expert on quiet zones, and we've been wanting to come back to the committee for a while just to provide an update on the two different zones that we're investigating. Definitely worth some discussion and some input from the committee, so we'll let Chris dive into it here.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. This is a brief agenda. Go through what the train horn rule is for everyone's information, the minimum requirements for a quiet zone. Go over the village or the city has two separate quiet zones potentially, and then just briefly touch on a grant the city received that would kind of have some quiet zone implications, and then answer any questions. So the train horn rule is the law that regulates train horns. It was established in 2005, and it's administered by the Federal Railroad Administration. They're the ones that have final say on the quiet zones. Basically, it requires that trains blow their horns in advance of any public highway rail crossing that is not grade separated or does not have a quiet zone implemented into it. So they must blow their horns a minimum of 15 seconds and a max of 20 seconds in advance. And then, you know, to reduce the noise, the rule did provide local communities the option of silencing them with a quiet zone. So a quiet zone, in order to have a quiet zone, basically there's a calculator based on the amount of traffic that your crossing has and if there's been any accidents, etc., that determines what your quiet zone risk index is. And there's also a risk index with horns. So if your risk index with horns of your intersection is 20,000, you need to make improvements to get below that 20,000 with them not blowing the horns. Those improvements consist of delineators, which is in the upper right-hand corner. That's the most common, cheapest option. A non-traversable median would be in the bottom. You can convert streets to one-way streets. You can completely close a crossing. And then the most expensive and last one would be those quad gates. Basically, the purpose of these improvements is to provide, stop people from being able to go onto the other lane of traffic to go around the gate, or basically circumnavigate the gates. And each one of these has a predetermined deduction in your risk index that is predetermined through engineering study from the FRA. So generally speaking, you can get into the requirements with delineators in order to qualify for a quiet zone. And then a couple other things, it has to be a half mile. So if you have any crossing that's within a half mile, that needs to be included in the proposed quiet zone, even if that's not under your jurisdiction. So if you had a road that was within a half mile at into the crossing, that would have to be included into that quiet zone by default. Then each crossing, at a minimum, in order to qualify for a quiet zone, needs to have flashing lights, needs to have gates, and then it needs to have a detection system called constant warning time, which basically detects, helps detect and drop the gates and the lights that go off when the train's approaching the crossing. Then you have to have an on-site meeting, a diagnostic meeting with you, with the Federal Railroad Administration, whatever railroad operates on the line. The Illinois Commerce Commission is who from the state helps with the quiet zones, and then also your DOT, so District 3 in this. Then you would provide a notice of intent to install a quiet zone to the FRA, everyone that is on the line, and that's basically you stating your intent to begin the quiet zone process that allows a 60-day comment period from any of the entities and the public about the quiet zone. They're allowed to comment on it. Depending on the comments, you may have to respond, you might not. The railroad is always gonna comment that they are not in support of the quiet zones. In their opinion, nothing's more safe than them blowing their horns. That's more just their blanket, you know, we're getting it out there that we don't support this. And then you ultimately don't have to respond to their comments unless they're legitimate safety concerns. Then you would install the proposed safety measures, and then you would go through what's called the notice of establishment, which is basically you filing with the FRA and the railroad that we put up our quiet zone improvements. This is the date the quiet zone is going to go live. This is when the conductors need to stop blowing their horns, and it's got to be, I think it's 21 days notice from when you mail out the notice of establishment to when that quiet zone can actually be implemented. And then they send that out to the railroad will send that out to their engineers. Obviously, there's some changed behavior that the engineers need to have to stop blowing their horns at crossings they've blown their horns out in the past. So I handed out exhibits to everyone. So there's two separate quiet zones. One's the BNSF line, which would include Beecher Road, Cannonball Trail, which is actually county, and then Kennedy Road and Mill Road. So the Cannonball Trail is actually getting implemented a quiet zone. The notice of establishment was just sent out 2 weeks ago, and the quiet zone should be active come October through the county. So the county went through and moved forward with that, and then the city's looking to move forward with their crossings at Beecher, Kennedy, and Mill. So right now, all the crossings are equipped with the correct equipment, the gates, the constant warning time, and lights. The one thing to be noted would be the pedestrian crossing at Kennedy Road will need to be reviewed by the diagnostic team in the field to see if anything special needs to happen with that. But that also has gates and lights, so I don't anticipate that being an issue. You just need to, most likely we'll have to provide no train horn signage and detectable warnings for the bike path, separate signage for the bike path and the road. Each of these, we're looking to install delineators. 100 feet is the minimum amount of delineators you can install. So looking to install 100 feet of delineators at either side of the crossing, and it's estimated to purchase the delineators. Public Works staff would be able to install the delineators. It's anticipated that it's about $20,000 per crossing. I think it's a little bit less when you buy the equipment in bulk, but we haven't looked at getting an official quote from everyone, so that's just a rough cost estimate for that. The one other thing unique about the BNSF quiet zone is they are requiring that the city enter into a preliminary engineering agreement with the railroad that would basically cover them doing a desktop review of the quiet zone, them attending the diagnostic meeting, their travel and attendance, and then includes any budget for follow-up, conference calls, other coordination. The railroad is currently estimated that at just over $28,000, but the city will be, and he did tell me in the email, he thinks that's high. We don't think they're going to need that all, but erred on the side of a number that I think they won't go over, and the city would ultimately be billed on the actual cost. So that would be kind of what we're asking for from the committee and the council is, do we want to move forward with that agreement with BNSF to move forward with getting the diagnostic meeting scheduled? Sorry, this schedule was based on going to the August Public Works Committee meeting, so, but obviously everything would move back a month, basically. Approval of the BNSF agreement in September, the diagnostic meeting would be in October, November, NOI, most likely in November at this point, and the quiet zone would be looking to get established probably February, March, or it could lead into the spring, because I'm sure getting the delineators in during the winter is going to be somewhat problematic, but that's kind of a tentative schedule for the BNSF quiet zone. And I kind of went through that, so the next step would be approval of the BNSF agreement. Assuming that gets approved, we would look to schedule the diagnostic meeting. The gentleman from BNSF has to come in from Kansas, so you know, getting that scheduled is not necessarily super quick. And then we got to coordinate with some ICC folks from Springfield, so that will take some time. We would go through the process of that, get the notice of intent submitted, and then look to get the notice of establishment and quiet zone established early, or late winter, early spring. So kind of flipping to the other one, which is the Omnitrax line. So that includes the Forest Preserve, Poplar Drive, River Birch Lane, kind of outside of downtown, and then various crossings downtown from Morgan all the way to Middle Street. So one of the big trouble issues with this quiet zone is that the majority of the crossings, specifically downtown, do not currently have any warning devices. So it's no gates, no lights, and no detection, no railroad detection. So in order to, first step in order to get them included in the quiet zone would be we need to get gates, constant warning time, and lights installed at all of those crossings. And that is estimated from the railroad at about $700,000 per crossing in order to get gates, lights, and that's a new crossing surface, so putting in either a new asphalt surface or new concrete surface on the crossing, gates, lights, and constant warning time. One thing to note is that there are some drainage concerns that the railroad had downtown that would need to be addressed as well, because constant warning time will not work in an area where the, you know, basically the electrical cables are constantly saturated. So there is some drainage improvements that would need to be done. The other thing is in order to even have room to put the gates in, you know, there needs to be enough room between the track and hydraulic in order to install a gate. So there needs to be about 10 feet between the edge of the pavement and the edge of the tracks in order to be able to install the gate mechanism, the lights, and the sign. So that would involve having to make some alignment shifts to hydraulic. There is a obviously we have to get an agreement between the railroad and the city in order to lay out, you know, who's doing what, responsibility, cost, and then they did say it takes about 90 days to get the material, and it would be 3 weeks of construction.
Hey Chris, one thing, when we were down there and met with the railroad, if you want a good reference point, if you go down and stand like by Foxy's and look towards 47, you'll see how far north that crossing gate is. That's where they'll all have to be. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So it's a really good reference point. You can see how far north it is, and you will lose the lane, that southern lane of hydraulic.
So funding possibilities, there is the grade crossing inventory fund that's administered through the state. It's a rolling, every year there's a call. The city would be able to apply for those, as would the railroad, to help pay for the crossing updates. The other thing that we've talked about is possibly closing some of the crossings. So we did do traffic counts last winter and early spring to see how many people are using each crossing. That still needs to be reviewed and recommendations would need to be made. And the idea would be to get public info and meet with the public to get that. But, you know, tentatively, I think the idea would be to potentially look into closing one or two of the crossings on the west side of 47. Most likely State and
Adams.
Where and then Morgan and Main would remain open since those were the majority of the where the traffic would go. But that all needs to be, you know, like I said, reviewed with the public, reviewed with the council. But that would allow you to get credit for closing your crossing. Obviously, then you don't have to do gates, new crossings, etc. at those crossings. And then there are some other federal opportunities, currently none available, but the railroad did say that typically they come out in October, so we'll be looking to see if anything will be coming out. And then the railroad did express they would be willing to partner with the city on applications. They seemed, at least with the folks, I didn't deal with the office people and more with the field side, but they seemed enthusiastic about understanding that this is a problem and trying to get it addressed. You know, there could be other state opportunities that come up, and then, I know this is the next agenda item, and I'll briefly touch on it on the next slide. There's a city qualified for an ITAP grant on East Hydraulic from 47 to basically Mill Street, and some of that includes improvements to hydraulic, safety considerations with the railroad, and trying to get in new gates and crossings. So I think what we're looking for is just, is there an appetite to move forward to continue investigating this and looking at what the next options? If we were, we would be looking to set up a meeting with the FRA just to confirm that the improvements we're making would be able to help the city qualify for a quiet zone. We would then move towards, making recommendations on what the improvements would consist, including improvements to hydraulic. We would meet with the public, meet with staff and city council, then we would begin to investigate any grants or funding opportunities that would be made available, and then ultimately engage the railroad to discuss agreements and how to get, the proper detection gates and lights installed. And then this is kind of just a brief overview of what we're intending to do on East Hydraulic. So the intent is to make that a one-way street that would then push the southern end edge of pavement far enough away from the tracks to put in gates at the alley, Hustis and Mill, as well as provide enough room to provide a fence to have a more physical barrier between the road and the crossing, and also would include installing designated sidewalk crossings to provide people a more safe way of getting to the river and getting to the restaurants without just crossing the tracks wherever they would like. And the city was selected for the grant. It's an 80-20 split for phase two, phase three, and construction. The city would be on the hook 100% for the phase one costs. And then, that's the potential project schedule. Phase one is going to take 18 to 24 months. We would start the phase two in early 2027 and look to construct in 2029. So it is a very long time frame, but there is a lot of paperwork and environmental clearances that need to be done to meet the federal requirements for the funding. So happy.
Will we still need all the delineators on all the crossings?
Yes, or we would go, you could go like the quad gates if you wanted to. Yes, we'd have to do something.
Okay.
Do we know how much of the grade crossing protection fund or whatever, this one, grade crossing inventory fund, like if each crossing is 700 grand to do gate signals and the warning time, like is it a 50-50, is it 2080, is it unlimited?
I think it's 90-10 for crossing improvements, I believe.
I think that's right.
Fed 90, local 10?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know ultimately if it's state money or fed money,
okay.
But
not ours. Okay,
yes.
So it's only a 10% match, so hopefully we can get it down to $70,000 per crossing that would need all those things, which some of them don't.
So some of these two, so Hoover and River Birch do not. These two do not. This one would just need gates and then that, and then one. You know, depending on if you, assuming you get rid of these two,
right?
You talk about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 crossings.
Okay. So $5 million in total improvements. That was a grab number, with hopefully only 10% of that back. So I mean, it would still be a pretty significant undertaking.
Yes.
And my guess are, you know, is our local match would probably require a fair amount of coordination, engineering, improvements, and other things that would push that dollar value, you know, much more than $500,000. But that's, you know, if that's possible, you know, through a grant, that's, you know, it's within distance of us being able to do it with some priorities.
So. If you look at that list, this is a big undertaking.
It is.
There's nothing small about this project.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of crossings.
Yeah.
And I will say the one thing that, I'm still a little unsure on, because the private crossings need the diagnostic team to review, which what happens to the private crossings beyond Mill Street.
Gotcha.
And what the responsibility is there. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, because how many are there past Mill Street for half mile?
Quite a few.
Right.
Yeah, there's driveways up and down the end of the road, you know? And the park is starting right here on the edge of the map,
right
here on the east end. So, yeah, so that would complicate it pretty significantly. And or even if they didn't make us touch those at all, you'd still probably hear the train.
There's a
somewhere.
Chance that the train could blow their,
yep.
You know, blow their horn still at those crossings.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got to anticipate it for the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They don't fall beside a half mile.
Right, it may or may not, and then the practical is that if it does fall outside and they don't request to touch it, you know, you still may hear the train coming from different directions. So it's a quiet zone. It may not be that quiet. It might be quieter, you know?
That's better.
Right.
Quieter.
So, okay, so then the next steps on both of these are, for the easier one, it's the BNSF agreement, so that's like $30,000, and then we're only looking at probably, you know, $60,000 to $100,000 is my guess in improvements to actually do the quiet zones. The southern one, though, is obviously a lot more intensive. So I don't know that we've estimated that on the front end, how much time.
I mean, we are under you know, agreement to do additional work associated with that downtown one, to meet with FRA and do public meetings and investigate options if so, you know,
that's
everyone wants to.
Because it's scope.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So.
Where are most of the complaints about train horns coming from? Joe?
White Oak. That's why I say just close River First Drive.
I would say
Mill Road is
in years past when this has been discussed.
Yeah,
the Mill Road area, like the north end of Grand Reserve, has been pretty intense. And then White Oak for sure.
How long have these tracks been here?
1880s.
1880s.
For downtown.
Yeah. What about those houses?
Exactly.
Were they built after the railroad tracks? Yeah.
1980s.
Oh, so 100 years the tracks before those houses went in. Oh. I see.
Any other questions?
I mean, closing some of those roads anyways just makes sense, whether we actually make a quiet zone or not. I do agree with all the ones that are passed. Might not still make it that quiet down there. I guess that would be something we could count at Mill Street half mile. I mean, part, there's got to be quite a few. We'll find out, I guess.
Yep.
And those trains are moving pretty slow, right?
Yeah, the downtown ones are.
Right. Yes. Oh, yeah.
I could hear that over the mic. definitely goes over about the 20 seconds.
Oh, the downtown one?
I think part of the problem is you have all these crossings mm-hmm. in a row, so it's technically
just
20
seconds
for each.
He just pulls on it.
He just hangs on it. Yep. I'm going. Sure he right. just hangs on it until he goes through. Especially with
festival.
With no gates,
no
and,
gates.
And the knowledge that there's people downtown walking across the tracks regularly. Yeah, I don't.
So, of course, you did state that if you had the meeting, you would be able to find out what's going to be required to the east and
yes.
confirm what's happening, what the proposed improvements have to be in the downtown.
Correct. Right? Yes.
So, how much additional effort, is that from our side?
Well, the idea would be when they're in town to do that. Well, assuming we want to move forward with BNSF,
there you go.
I'm assuming most folks are okay with that. Is that we would. I would take the FRA
yeah.
person after that meeting and say, hey,
yeah.
the city's looking at doing something downtown. Can we just preliminary go look at it together?
Okay.
So not, I don't think a huge undertaking.
Okay.
So I guess the staff recommendation would be to move forward with the BNSF engineering agreement for about $30,000, proceed with that, and then that'll give us some definitive cost estimates and then approvals, obviously, to do so, and then to explore, I guess, the southern and see if it gets legs with either grant funding or closure funding available to be able to, do it at some point in the future.
Yeah.
Okay.
Andy, anybody else?
Thanks.
Thank you.
You guys think on that one?
Wasn't as fun as the water presentation.
Well, that one we have no choice except to give a thumbs up. This one we can go with that.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. You can do one up and one down.
That's true. I think that's probably
where
it's probably one up and one down.
Yeah.
I mean, would you recommend next month?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll bring it back to
I think getting
PDB.
The downtown quiet zone is going to be a tough sell.
Big staff recommendation to October PW.
Yeah, we're going to bring the BNSF agreement back here for review and discussion.
And moving on, item number four, PW 2025-84, East Hydraulic District ITEP Grant Phase 1.
So Chris alluded in his presentation that we would like to move forward with phase one engineering for the $3 million grant that we got for the hydraulic street project. It's a streetscape project with multiple items within the grant, but this is the first phase that is not covered by the grant. Phase two and phase three construction will be a match. So we'll come back for that. But right now, we're just asking for the phase one engineering in the amount of $263,354. At the time of the budget, we did not have the grant award yet. So we would also ask for the approval of the budget amendment along with this.
Sounds good to me.
Fine with that. Since we are doing the budget amendment, we have to go.
Yeah, it could go on consent agenda if you wanted to, but this was probably good for the end. Just wanted to note, I know we touched on the quiet zone presentation. There's 2 years of phase one engineering on this, and then probably another year, so nothing gets constructed until probably 2029.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Anybody else? Anything? Moving on. Item number five, PW 2025-85, Cannonball Trail Shared Use Path Feasibility Study Presentation.
All right, it's Chris's night tonight. So he's going to walk through some of the findings from the conceptual analysis that that the city has asked us to take a look at.
Okay, thank you. So just brief, but review of what our project scope was. We ultimately came up with four different options, review of the cost, and I'm happy to answer any questions. So project scope was to you know, provide a connection from Route 34 to Route 47. There's existing a bike path on Cannonball Trail from Route 34 to Blackberry Shore Lane as it sits now. So to basically make the connection from Blackberry Shore Lane to Route 47. It'd be a 10-foot wide shared use path, similar to what you see there is, you know, the path that exists off of Route 47 right now on 8 inches of stone with 3 inches of asphalt. There would be tree removal in spots. Obviously, you got to excavate the earth out. There would be some drainage improvements, specifically near Blackberry Shore, just I guess that would be east of Blackberry Shore Lane and east of the village's or city's lift station. Striping and signage, and then restoration. So our options, we looked at 4 different options. Option 1 is install the path completely on the west/north side of the road. That would involve needing to get right away from 5 different parcels. And then option, I'll just briefly talk about each of the options. Option 2, basically to install it on the opposite side of the street. Option 3 is kind of like a hybrid, where some of it's on one side and some of it's on the other. And then option 4 would be to kind of circumvent some of the problem areas between Alice and Route 47 by going through Whispering Meadows and then over 47 behind the
Aurora Textiles.
Thank you, Eric. So option 1, the estimated costs for right-of-way acquisition, engineering, and construction is at $795,000. So we kind of did the pros and cons associated with the options. So this provides a direct connection from Route 34 to Route 47, which option 4 would not. There are limited utility options on this side as opposed to the other side. It does require right away from 5 parcels. Some of the difficulties. So this is the section I was talking about related to drainage improvements. So there is a significant amount of, you know, regrading, some storm sewer extension, possibly some guardrail improvements that would need to be made in order to install a path there in that picture, the upper picture. There is significant landscaping and trees at 3193 Cannonball, which is in that bottom picture, that would need to be disturbed in order to put the path in, and then there would be no direct connection. You'd have to cross Cannonball in order for the residents unincorporated residents on Amanda to access this path. Option 2 would be installing it on the other side of the street. As noted, there is a significantly more amount of right-of-way that needs to be purchased as part of this option. So with that comes additional costs. So cost all in with engineering, construction, and right-of-way for that is estimated at just over $1 million. Again, the pros, it provides a direct connection to 34 and 47. This provides direct connection, so the unincorporated residents on Amanda and Patricia do not need to cross Cannonball Trail to access the path. It is the most expensive option. It does require the most amount of right-of-way, 15 parcels that we would need to purchase right-of-way and negotiate. There are some utility conflicts that you can see there in that upper picture, with you know, ComEd pole, assuming that's AT&T or some sort of telecommunications. And then the culvert crossing was difficult on the other side. It's much even more difficult on this side. Option 3 would be to put it all on the west/north side till you get up to, I think that's like a church up there, basically at Amanda Lane. You would then cross to the other side and put it in on the other side, and then cross back at Patricia in order to utilize the existing path that's already been installed at the corner. Option 3A would be basically to keep it all on the south side as opposed to crossing, and then you wouldn't be utilizing this section of the path as an option. So it's slightly it's the cheapest of the Cannonball Trail options because there's less tree removal and less landscape improvements that would need to be made at 3193 Cannonball. And this also provides the connection to the unincorporated folks on Amanda and Patricia. The cons of option 3 and option 3A eliminates one of these is that you do have an unsignalized crossing on Cannonball, which is, you know, a little problematic given the speeds and the traffic that are out there. And you still have some utility conflicts near Amanda Lane, as you can see in the picture on the bottom. And you know, you still have to deal with that Culver crossing at Blackberry Shore Lane. Option 3A is a little bit more expensive because you have a little bit more new path to install and you got to rip out some of the old path, but you do only have one unsignalized crossing instead of two. Option 4 would be to put the in-path on the north side from Blackberry Shore Lane up to Alice Avenue. We would then utilize Alice Ave and Faxon as an on-street bike lane. Due to the width of those roads, they're more than capable of being able to handle traffic and shared bike in the same lane. So that would just require striping and signage on that location. And then we would put a path in at the end of Faxon behind Aurora Textiles out to Route 47. So there's four parcels we would need to get right away. It is the cheapest option, about $100,000 cheaper than option 3. So there is no utility conflicts associated with that. There is, you know, the downside is there's not a direct connection from Route 47 to Route 34. It does not provide any connection for the unincorporated residents at Amanda and Patricia. And then, you know, it does provide for a large section of a bike lane versus a bike path. Although roads are plenty big, it's just anytime you've got people in the street, it's a little less safe than on a separate path. So here's just a summary of the costs, and the land acquisition costs are noted there. And with that, happy to answer any questions.
One other thing, the last time we put in the, like, the flashers for the crossings, they were probably about 20 to 25,000, so I would figure 25 to 30 easily per crossing.
Yeah, that would be one way to try and solve that unsignalized crossing. That Cannonball would be to try and put in a flasher like that. That's not currently in the estimate, but that would be a potential way to mitigate some of that concern if we went that route.
Do we have to go up Cannonball?
That was a request.
I mean, that was the request.
I'm just saying, if we went up Beecher, you could kind of snake around through Beecher and cut off that Culver crossing and all that, and we already got all the easement we need.
We had the persons on Patricia Lane.
Yeah.
Somebody got hit on the bike.
Yeah. Any thoughts?
So the outcome of this was just give you cost estimates. This is not budgeted. Nobody's asked us to construct this yet, but you wanted to see if the, I think we gave it $1 million grab figure, you know, at a previous meeting. And so that bears that out a little bit. Gives you a couple things to ask for if you ever decide that you want to move forward with this.
There would be grants potentially available. ITEP being one of them. There's the next call for ITEP projects would be next August. You wouldn't find out if you got funding until the following spring, so that would be 2027. And earliest construction would probably be 2030, if you were to go down that route. That's the most probably effective way of trying to get funding to help pay for the project, grant-wise.
In that time, how much would prices increase?
Yep. And what would it connect to at 47?
The trail.
It would connect to future trails.
Yeah, there's not one there now, though.
Correct.
Yeah. Plans.
For
the plan
for the expansion.
Yeah. Correct. So, yeah, if you look at those exhibits, the
purple
I think
line.
It's the purple line.
Right.
That would be
correct.
The future Route 47 path when the road gets expanded.
Yes. Which, if they go next year, Dan, will probably be 2029 before that's finished as well.
Right. So right now it's a path to nowhere.
To nowhere.
If we were to potentially look into moving forward, what would be the time frame you would need a decision in order to be able to apply for the next cycle of grants?
Next summer.
Next June.
About a year from now, actually.
Yes.
Because they come out in September.
Yes. They come out the same time that the same, you know, this current state Russell School Green would be. So yeah, you'd be looking to submit the application about this time mm-hmm. next year. If you wanted to try and get out that building.
Any thoughts? I think I'd like to discuss this more with Matt and Chris. It potentially affects them more than any of us.
I guess they'll really do it. You know, as a role in the first one. This two streets got to be done with it.
Without the crossings.
Right.
Without going through the Spring Meadows. Is that what it was for Spring Meadows? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah.
And we do, I mean, there is right away where that gentleman has the landscaping and the trees. So mm-hmm. we have the right to go in there and put the path. He's not going to be happy about that, but.
Legal costs, are those fixed into here too? No? Can we file a lawsuit?
We can't account for those.
Yeah.
Was it the just one household that wanted us to look at this?
Yeah, I think that was, you know, who attended. Whether there's other people up and down, you know, their block that agree with them is a different story, but yeah, I think only one person really has asked us to take a look at it.
I understand they have accident, but it's not exactly a good road to drive on, and they're aware of when they did it. It's a lot of money.
Yep.
I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but I just apply for a person to get grant money for it, see if that project kind of lines up for when 47 is running and it's actually useful.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think you probably get more interest in that type of path once markers 55 and older, small lot, single family residences are complete.
Yep.
They're probably going to want to walk around.
Yep.
Sure. It'd be a nice way for them to do so, but they're a ways out from closing on those properties.
Sure. Okay.
You guys in favor of bringing it back to committee then?
Not about you, yeah.
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 When it's grant time.
Yeah, we'll make a note for the ITEP grant next cycle and mm-hmm. go from there.
And then maybe notify Matt and Chris if they haven't seen this.
Okay.
Let them have a, have a look.
Okay.
Moving on, item number six, PW 2025-86, Kane Kendall Council of Mayors, KK Khan, call for projects.
All right, speaking of grant funds, keeping on that theme. So the Kane Kendall Council of Mayors, they're the ones that get the federal funds, STP dollars, that are handed down, and then they distribute them throughout the Kane Kendall communities. So basically about every 2 years, they have a call for projects to keep their five-year plan up to speed and spend the allocated money. They are coming out for a call this fall and anticipate submittals in December of this year. So we're bringing it forth to the committee to get a concurrence on whether or not you want to submit this year. So the city has been successful in the past. We just completed Van Emmon with a resurfacing project that was using STP funds from the King Kendall Council of Mayors, Bristol Ridge Road, Kennedy Road, and you know, Game Farm Road or some other projects that have taken advantage in the past. So these particular projects, the only streets that are eligible are called called FAU routes. So there's a limited amount of streets within the city that are eligible for funding, and those are shown in an exhibit behind the memo. So at this point, we've reviewed them at a staff level, you know, certainly discussed them with Eric and John, and we have three potential recommendations that the committee is agreeable to move forward with. And one is Cannonball Trail from 34 to 47. That would be a resurfacing, basically a milling and resurfacing project. Game Farm Road, surprisingly, You know, that pavement is 10 years old right now, and by the time this money becomes available, it's going to be 15 years old, so probably due for resurfacing. So we definitely recommend that one. We have a feeling that would score well as well. And then sections of Kennedy Road as well, you know, pretty high traffic volume. That's a big trigger and a big scoring, big addition to the scoring as they review the projects at the council of mayor staff level. So basically all of the three of those projects we feel would score pretty well and have a pretty good chance of getting funding down the road. So Chris, this funding, I forget, but it is like 2028, 2029, I think.
I think it's 2029
and 2030. Yeah, so, you know, by the time you go through the applications and the projects get selected, you're 4 or 5 years, down the road, if you will, here. So at this point, that's our recommendation, is to move forward with all three and looking for concurrence or additional discussion.
Okay. Okay. Put that on consent.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on. Item number 7, PW 2025-87, resolution approving an engineering agreement with Engineering Enterprises Incorporated for the 2026 Road to Better Roads Program Design Engineer.
This is not a grant. Nor is it an application. This is our I think this is our smaller program. This is our MFT program for design for next year's. We're already starting to think about that. EEI is proposing a design fee of $89,914 and direct expenses at $6,000 for a total of $95,914. There's 92 budgeted right now, 92,000. So we're just slightly over, but we think we can obviously make up that little bit of money in the overall project.
Questions?
No.
You good with that? Move that under consent? Sure. Moving on, item number 8, PW 2025-88, resolution approving an engineering agreement with Engineering Enterprises Incorporated for the 2026 Local Road Program Design Engineering.
This is the bigger pavement program that we've been doing. It will be the third year, I believe, with this one included, where we're trying to get ahead of all those subdivisions that were built in the early 2000s. This and then one more big push, and we should be caught up then, I believe. But this one is a larger program. It includes areas of Raintree, and then it also includes areas behind the water project. It looks like Adrian and Dolph, and then Mill, Fox, and a lot of that older area over by Circle Center School as well. So it's a very large program, and their engineering fee for the design work looks to be about $194,732 for that work. Is there any questions, comments?
That's already in the budget?
Yeah, it's a little over what is in the budget, but again, we could do under for the actual work to keep the whole thing on budget.
Questions?
No.
You guys okay with consent on that one too? Moving on, item number 9, PW 2025-89, resolution approving a change order to a contract to construct 1.5 million gallon standpipe and water main, South Receiving Station standpipe, change order number 2.
All right, so this is for the standpipe down as near the southern connection points of the DWC Lake Michigan line. So we continue to look at ways to value engineer and reduce costs on this particular project. So we did have quite a bit of site work associated with this project. And just looking at the bids, the numbers came in substantially higher than we would have expected for water main and underground and things such as that. So we're basically recommending to take that type of work out of this particular contract and put it into the Route 126 water main work. which is going out to bid. It's an underground contract. You know, we want them to do additional underground work. Definitely anticipating costs to be substantially lower. So there'll be a reduction, recommended reduction from this contract of 158,000 and change, and then you know there'll be at work added into the 126 contract, but we estimate a net savings of at least $90,000, perhaps even more by making this change. So we are recommending moving forward with this change. Yeah.
Questions? Down against that as well. Moving on, item number 10, VW 2025-90, next AMP plat or dedication and grant of easements.
All right, next AMP is moving forward with their two solar projects. Along with those projects, they do have some right-of-way to be dedicated along Cornelius Road as they abut Cornelius Road, and then there's also some easements that we're seeking adjacent to existing right-of-way. So just moving through the development process, these are you know items that need to be addressed. They have submitted the plats for review. We have reviewed them and found them to be acceptable, and we recommend that the city accept the dedication and the grants of easement and allow the mayor and clerk to ultimately execute.
You ready? I think we can accept that and move that on to consent as well.
Yep.
Item number 11, PW 2025-91, Faxon Road and Beecher Road reconstruction, rejection of bids.
Right, back in May, we received bids for the reconstruction of these projects or these two streets. So this was generated and driven by the Cyrus One project. So within the agreements with Cyrus One, basically the city was to design and go out to bid. Cyrus One was to pay for this roadway reconstruction. And originally, we were trying to you know get things done by an August timeframe to meet their development schedule. You know their project hasn't moved forward. You know with construction as of yet, and we also hadn't been able to obtain all the right-of-way needed to be able to do this work. And some of the right-of-way is kind of hinging upon some of the work that Cyrus One is doing and some possible land additional land acquisition. So the bottom line is, you know, we're running out of time. We're not going to be able to rebuild the roadways. We don't have the right-of-way. Cyrus One is not moving forward. So we're recommending that rejecting the bids. We'll work on acquiring the right-of-way over the winter time, work with Cyrus One, come up with a new schedule, and basically bid the project back out once we're in agreement on what the new schedule is. So at this time, we're just recommending a rejection of the bids, and we have an example letter within the packet.
Questions? Yeah, I think we can move that on to consent as well. Item number 12, PW 2025-92, resolution pledging financial commitment in support of an Illinois Department of Transportation's Safe Routes to School grant application for Yorkville Prairie Meadows Sidewalk Gap Project.
This is another grant program that we're looking to apply for on October 15th in cooperation with the school district. So right now, the resolution is for funding and support of the overall project. We are still waiting on the school district for a letter of support and a parent survey. So once we have that, we would have the ability to go ahead and apply for this. But we're looking at completing the sidewalk gaps in the Prairie Meadows subdivision, which is just to the north of us. So it will highly benefit Autumn Creek Elementary School. Looking at this as a great project for these funds. The state is very supportive of this. I've talked to just the director that kind of monitors these and said this is what this program is for, to go ahead and apply for it. So he was encouraging of us to do so as well. So this is the only step that will need to go before you, but I did put in the grant application in the packet along with the project location map. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Everybody okay?
Yeah.
Okay, we can move on to the consent as well. Item number 13, PW 2025-93, Moda Homes Call of Performance Funds.
All right, so there's a nice memo in your package about some of the lack of progress both in the building permits and the public infrastructure in Bristol Bay. The building permits is within Pete's control. He can basically rescind a permit if he feels the need to. And we're probably getting close to that point, given that there's been some vandalism out there to a bunch of the doors and windows and siding on the property that has not been repaired for months. They are doing some limited siding work out there, but they're not repairing any of the damage that's occurred, which has been our specific ask on the building permit for a few months. On the public infrastructure, which is what this bond call is, they have 4 years under the UDO basically to complete sidewalks, streets, water, sewer, stormwater, street lights, all those things. And at each year, they're supposed to give us an update as to what their completion schedule has been. Right now, they have not done any significant public infrastructure work in probably more than a year, despite us asking for some updates there. And so because they've missed deadlines asking us for their completion schedule for the last year of their four-year schedule, we're having to threaten or actually do a bond call based on their non-response and lack of work. It is not unnormal for a developer to do a bunch of work in year zero or year one of this four-year project, do almost no work through the middle of the project if they're building houses, and then button up all the infrastructure at the end of the project. It just usually does not take 4 years. Usually does not have a developer who refuses to repair windows and doors that have been damaged, and they're usually responsive when you ask them for what their schedule is. So because they've violated those portions of the code, we're recommending to call the bond and proceed forward with completing the public infrastructure ourselves if they do not respond to us in time. Yeah. So we've given them four notices formally. It's been months of work. We have a fair amount of residents in the subdivision, including the HOA, who've been unsatisfied with the construction and construction of the buildings and construction of the public infrastructure. And they've asked why we haven't called the bond already, and this is the first opportunity for us to do so, given that there's some non-response in relation to the completion of the public infrastructure. So that's our recommendation.
I've never before.
Bond's going to be enough to do all the improvements?
Yeah. Yeah, did a reduction last year at some point or another.
Yeah, we did in one of the units. We recently updated our punch list, and along with that created estimates to go along with the remaining work. And yes, we feel that there's enough money to complete the work.
So and just as a heads up, in case we do the bond call and complete the infrastructure, one of the units is completely built out. I forget which one. So that one won't be an issue to kind of button everything up. One of them is about a third built out, so not ideal from completing the infrastructure because some of it might get damaged during construction. And one of it is like 0% built out. So that one we may have to be a little bit more strategic on, what we do and when we do it, given construction inflation and available funding.
Anybody have anything? What do you guys think about bringing this one back to the committee, or to the whole council? I'd like to have Chris and Wayne on.
Sure.
Okay, we're going to move that forward to the council. Old business, item number one, PW 2025-62. Resolution approving an engineering agreement with Engineering Enterprises Incorporated for a 2025 stormwater basin inspection.
This hasn't changed in a few months, including the fact that I have not had a chance to discuss it in depth in there. So we can push this another month, and I'll try to get it done before next month.
Any additional business? Okay, you can call me. 7:19.